I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. A few years ago, we were living in what was called the golden age of television. And now we are apparently dealing with something called peak TV. John Landgraf, the CEO of FX, predicted that there will be 400 original scripted shows for TV this year on cable, broadcast, and through streaming. He said we had reached peak TV in America and the numbers would drop over the next few years. The problem, according to Landgraf, is that good shows can get lost and not find their audience with such a crowded TV landscape. As for viewers, how many times have you heard someone say, there's just too much TV or too much good TV these days? Well, we wanted to explore the state of television and what this abundance means for the people who make TV, those who watch it, and those who critique it. And we have two guests who have joined us. James Poniewozik is TV critic for the New York Times, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Eric Adams, TV editor for the AV Club. He hosts their podcast, I Know It Sounds Crazy. And Eric Adams, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to have you both here. James, what is the CEO of FX, John Landgraf, what was he complaining about? And why did what he said get such play, such attention?
Well, I think it was partly because he said it among a room of TV critics and reporters. I wasn't actually there, but was following the coverage, and it's something that rings true to us because it's just increasingly impossible. Certainly, even if you do this for a living, to follow everything that's out there, much less if you're a person with an actual real productive job who just in your spare time.
Right.
But I also think that there are sort of two phenomena that we're talking about here. One of which is the sort of cultural, civilian experience of I've got a limited amount of time and, what do I choose and so forth. And then I think one thing that he was talking about was sort of a business factor, which is there are more and more TV shows, original scripted TV shows, being produced by more and more outlets, broadcast networks, cable networks, premium cable networks like, AMC that 10 years ago didn't produce original scripted series at all, and all sorts of other even more obscure cable channels, streaming networks, Amazon used to be a bookstore, now it's a TV network.
Right.
And the business question, one business question that he was raising is simply, these shows cost money to produce and they're cutting the audience into smaller and smaller slices. How much longer can this sustain itself as a business model? Will all these new players be able to continue doing it, or at some point, does it become sort of like a bubble that has to collapse?
Well, Eric, let me quote something that the CEO of FX said. He said, this glut of shows has created a huge challenge in finding compelling original stories and the level of talent needed to sustain those stories. He also talked about the enormous impact on everyone's ability to cut through the clutter and create real buzz. I mean, is this, in a sense, a business problem for people who make TV these days?
I think it's definitely more of a business problem than it is a creative problem. One of the bright sides of peak TV, as we've been discussing in critical circles since this talk was given by John Landgraf, is that by spreading the wealth of who makes TV and who broadcasts TV, it gives more opportunities to creative voices that we might not have heard from previously. A great example to cite is Amazon's Transparent. We probably would not have seen a show about a family working through the transition of a transgender father were it not for this opportunity for, like James said, a former bookstore to sort of open up and take an idea that I believe Jill Soloway had shopped to other outlets, and Amazon was just the one who saw the potential in it because they created the potential for it.
Well, and I saw some quotes, the head of Hulu saying, TV is better for it. Netflix said they will continue to expand their offerings. HBO said if it's good, it will find its place. Is the FX CEO, Eric, kind of a Chicken Little type person?
I would hesitate to call John Landgraf a Chicken Little.
I don't know the guy, but yes.
He's very, very savvy. Part of the reason that these statements that he makes get the attention of the press and then get filtered down to the larger television audience is because he's like catnip for the TV critics. He's very smart. He's been in the business for a while, and he's right a lot of the time. You know, prior to this, at the same event a few years previously, he talked about how the streaming outlets were going to become a major force in television production. I think this was 2013 or 2014 when Netflix was just starting to make its own original programming, and that prediction came true. It was a very prescient statement that all of a sudden the marketplace was going to get very crowded. So if there's any sort of Chicken Little attitude going on, it's because Landgraf's own predictions have come true.
Well, James, as I was thinking about this, you know, you don't hear people complaining, including people that read books, you know, there are just too many books out there, or there are just too many movies, or people are composing too much music. I mean, no one ever seems to think that that's a problem, even the people who are publishers who have to compete with each other, for instance.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's partly just a condition of the expectations that we, you know, have had for TV, which carries over from a time when there was relatively little of it. There were a few broadcast networks, and you know what they aired was on, and you know their major shows were on in prime time, and that was what you had to choose from. I would caution against, although I think this is a very interesting phenomenon, and I think that Landgraf cites, you know, a real business issue. I would caution between conflating a potential problem for the business people in TV with a problem for the viewers of TV. You know, I think net.
Yeah, we're happy about this, I have to say, right?
maybe there's a little bit of a glut of choice, but you know, it's generally a very good thing for people who consume TV as an art form. FX's problem is not necessarily your problem.
Well, and out of all this quantity, though, James, are we seeing quality? I mean, this sort of golden age of television that, frankly, from my perspective, seems to have continued, is having all these choices been essentially good for TV?
Sure. I mean, I'm not so interested in the, you know, kind of parlor game that people sometimes do of comparing one era of television versus another, this decade versus that decade. But the fact is, there is just so much more television that there's almost necessarily much more very good television. And because shows can, you know, seek out more different sort of specific audiences, it creates more opportunity for, you know, the kind of specificity that, as Eric said, you see in a show like Transparent, which itself promotes creativity and originality and sort of, you know, audacious, interesting programming. So, you know, is there a lot more terrible TV out there also? Yes, that's true. You know, and again, to go to your earlier point, you know, go to a bookstore sometime. You know, there
well,
are
exactly.
Terrible books out there.
Exactly.
You know, but the fact is, I would say that there is far more good TV than there used to be, and the best of it generally is better.
Eric, does that, though, create problems for critics like yourself and James, which is, you know, how do you stay up with all this stuff, and how do you, I guess, provide the kind of critique and analysis that's helpful to viewers, for instance?
Absolutely. I think it only creates problems for us. I think the reason that we've heard so much about peak TV and too much TV is because the people who are writing about it are experiencing that anxiety. I myself, personally, I've just had to divest myself from the idea that I can be as comprehensive as someone who held this job even 5 years ago was able to be. I'm in a fortunate position at the AV Club where we have a very large, very smart base of freelancers who are able to cover upwards of 60 TV shows at a time. But even then, that's not all of the TV. You know, it becomes this sort of prioritization process. The favored buzzword for it is curation, and the critic's role more and more is becoming this sort of curative role where you look at 400 scripted shows in a year and you say, okay, here are the, you know, the 60, maybe the 100 that you need to be watching right now, that you should be paying attention to. I always start to get a little anxious near this time of the year because it's coming down to best of the year list time, and I can't fathom thinking about what my 10 top shows of the year are, because there's been so much that I've enjoyed this year. Having to pick 5 programs to recommend later in this show was a process in and of itself. This fall isn't particularly great for new shows, but we're coming out of a summer where networks like Bravo and Lifetime, networks that we haven't expected to be producing quality scripted programming, produced some of the best shows of the year. Lifetime made this amazing critique and indictment of the reality TV industry called Unreal, which was one of the most compelling primetime soaps made in the last 10 years. Bravo made this great sitcom called Odd Mom Out, about a woman working her way through feeling like she's an outsider on the Upper East Side in New York. It's just, I think it goes back to that question of creating more opportunities for different types of stories to be told.
Would it be fair, James, just picking up on one of Landgraf's concerns, is that a good TV show just will never find its audience because there's so much to choose from? I mean, I'm sure that happens with books and music and all these other things that are part of our culture and part of our enjoyment, but that there are shows that should have found an audience that didn't. And is there anything new about that?
I think that's a danger, but to me, it's outweighed by the fact that you have so many shows that simply never would have been made or never would have been made in the way that they are now, many of them on Landgraf's own network, FX, that now exist because there are greater options and because the business model and the distribution of television is changing. There are different ways that you can monetize shows. There are ways of, there are shows that survive on the air with for several seasons with ratings that would have got them immediately canceled, 10, 15 years ago. You have, on FX, say, something like Louis, comedian Louis C.K.'s program, which is, this very individualistic vision of comedy and, philosophy and life that he basically makes, hands-on, like sort of a series of independent films, that sort of thing just couldn't have been made back in the three network era when, you needed 30 million viewers or whatever just to survive.
Well, hold on.
So I'll take that trade-off.
Okay, I will too, as a matter of fact. I happen to love the show, Louis. That's James Poniewozik, also with us, Eric Adams, and we're talking about TV today. Is there too much TV, too much good TV? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Eric Adams, TV editor for the AV Club, host of their podcast. I know it sounds crazy. Also with us, James Poniewozik, TV critic for the New York Times. And we're talking about the abundance, or in some cases, I guess, the overabundance of TV shows. You can join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us what you like, whether you think this is a problem of just too much television. Eric, I think you were talking about the fact that there were a lot of really good shows that came out this summer, the fall, not so much. I'm old enough to remember when summer rolled around, it was all reruns on television because they kind of figured no one would be watching, but that seems to have changed.
Oh, yeah, you can't really afford to run reruns these days just because the marketplace is both so saturated and so competitive. You can't give that airtime over. It's so valuable. And that's a shift that we've seen really in the past, within the past decade, accelerated in the last 5 years. The Breaking Bad effect, I think, had a tremendous impact on that, where, you know, you waited around until the summer to get a new season of Breaking Bad. Suddenly, the best and the most entertaining, the most excited, the most talked about show on TV wasn't coming around every fall. You had to wait until the networks were done with their stuff for AMC to bring a new batch of Breaking Bad. And so it's become a year-round thing. The fall is still important to the networks, just because the networks are old media institutions, and they like their traditions. They still do the upfronts every May. Thank goodness they still do. They still come to the Television Critics Association press tour every summer, which is where John Landgraf made these remarks about peak TV. And they still love rolling out their shows every fall, because it's something that the advertisers expect, and it's still a big deal, even if the quality of the content has kind of been scattered to the entire calendar year.
James, we have a caller. I want to get him on the air and give you a chance to respond to him. This is looks like Tony from Belmar, New Jersey. Tony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, folks. Good morning. I love this topic, and something I've been saying for a couple months now is it seems like, because there's so many shows on television, these young actors and actresses are not going to make any money on the first run. They're going to set up deals where it has to go into syndication, because I see all these pushes for box sets and all these different things. You're going to have a bunch of people not making any money working, and it's sad.
Well, Tony,
it's very sad.
Do you agree with that analysis, James?
Well, I'm not sure that scripted TV shows are getting cheaper to make, just in terms of what anybody's getting paid or whatever. It's definitely true that there are different ways, many different ways now of shows making money, and this is another thing that kind of affects the kind of TV that we see now, than simply the first airing and the money that they make from advertising from that. And actually, I think DVD sets are becoming, after just not a very long time in the sun, sort of a smaller part of that. And one thing that's becoming very big is selling shows, not even so much to syndication, but to the likes of Netflix and so forth. The video on demand, the streaming element of that. So that definitely is an aspect of it that's changing the business, that's changing the calculation as to what shows do you make and do you keep a show on the air? Is it worth it? But again, I think net, this is a good thing for actors in television, because
there are
more roles out there and the check is still clear.
Well, we asked both of you to give us some shows that you would like to share with our listeners, shows that you think that they should check out, and you both came up with The Leftovers. I should say season 2 of The Leftover begins on Sunday, October 4th. This is a monologue delivered from season 1 by Nora. She's played by Carrie Coon, and this is from season 1 of HBO's The Leftovers.
Dear Kevin, I need to say goodbye to someone I care about. Someone who's still here. So I'm saying it to you. You were good to me, Kevin. And sometimes when we were together, I remembered who I used to be before everything changed. But I was pretending. Pretending as if I hadn't lost everything. I want to believe it can all go back to the way it was. I want to believe that I'm not surrounded by the abandoned ruin of a dead civilization.
So why, James, on your list? I'll get to you, Eric. Why this a good show?
It's, to me, and increasingly in the first three episodes of the second season, which I've seen and are just fantastic.
Oh, wow.
This is a show that, while it does not have necessarily a specific religious standpoint, it is possibly the most excellent exploration of spirituality on TV that we're seeing right now. It's just to explain the premise briefly. It's adapted from a Tom Perrotta novel. that deals with the aftermath of a strange event called the sudden departure, in which 2% of the world's population randomly disappears. It sounds like this should be a, you know, science fiction, you know, slash supernatural mystery show, but it's very much, you know, overtly not interested in solving why this happened or what caused it. Was it aliens? Was it, you know, angels, et cetera? And it's much more in an exploration of how people deal with tragedy, you know, which you can apply metaphorically to any sort of things, any number of things that happen in the real world. How people deal with the fact that, you know, bad things happen to good people, things happen randomly, you're not necessarily going to get answers for it, and how do you continue on? It's a beautiful, well-written, and this season much more focused examination of, you know, what you could treat as, you know, a kind of sci-fi X-Filesy premise, but instead is, you know, without getting too pretentious about
sure.
it, just this gorgeous exploration of, you know, the meaning of life and the big questions.
Eric, you want to add to that?
Oh, absolutely. I think jump, you know, kind of springboarding from James's points, and also continuing from that monologue that we heard from the character of Nora. This is a show that addresses really difficult emotions to articulate on television, and emotions that we don't see on other shows. It's all about letting go and saying goodbye and moving on, and that's what's really impressive about this new season, which is like. It's one of the hardest reboots of a show I've ever seen between seasons. The season premiere this Sunday effectively acts as a pilot for a completely new show, but it still holds on to the emotional core, to the tone. You know, during that monologue, we heard the main theme, the main instrumental theme of the show, and just hearing that kind of raised the hairs on the back of my neck. This show is so emotionally rich, and that can make it very difficult to watch. It was very polarizing in its first season because it can be very, very emotionally bleak and a little bit nihilist. And you know, the fact that it doesn't provide any answers is very frustrating to people because, you know, as human beings, we seek out answers. We want to know the truth, but the difficult thing that The Leftovers tells us, as James was saying, is that sometimes the truth just doesn't present itself. And Tom Perata, who wrote the original novel, and David Lindelof, who famously worked on Lost and infamously promised all sorts of answers that he could never follow up on.
Indeed.
On Lost, have said, you know, they're not going to give the answers on The Leftovers. They're just going to leave things open to interpretation. And that, to me, is incredibly thrilling.
Well, and that is Eric Adams, TV editor for the AV Club. Also with us, James Poniewozik, TV critic for the New York Times. And we are going through their list of some of the TV programs that they have enjoyed that they think that you will enjoy as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And I have to say, I put this to you, James, going through both of your lists, what I found so interesting is that except for The Nick, I have never watched any of these programs. I guess speaking to what we were talking about earlier, which is that there is just so much. And people can find the kind of niche, you know, the things that they enjoy for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, I was almost going to use the dreaded phrase when I was talking about The Leftovers, you know, now this is not for everybody. but it's really kind of a, you know, truth of TV today that, you know, a lot of the best TV, and really a lot of TV in general, is you know, sort of by definition not for everybody, because you know we're no longer at, you know, that sort of water cooler era when you know 30 million of us, you know, watched, you know, Seinfeld, or you know, not even Seinfeld, what, 50 million people watched an episode of Mork and Mindy at one point in the 70s.
Yes,
you know, and now it's not simply like that. It is much more like, you know, the market for fiction, where, you know, there are a few blockbusters, but you know, not everybody is necessarily going to read that year's National Book Award winner.
Well, maybe it's just the people I hang out with and me, but I have to tell you that even with friends that I go out with, we talk about TV shows and we talk about the plots and the characters and what happened that week. I mean, it is something that people, maybe not at water coolers, but a kind of shared interest. Well, Jim, you picked a show called Grindr, and I wonder if you could just tell us just briefly what this show is about. It premiered on Fox this week on Tuesday, September 29th. It stars Rob Lowe.
Yes. The title of the show is The Grindr, which I guess I should say just to distinguish it from the dating app, which is probably but that's not the first time that's come up. But no, it's and as we discussed, this is not a fantastic fall for new broadcast network shows. The Grindr is one of the small pleasures of the new broadcast season. It's just a solid, enjoyable, professionally made comedy that is also a sort of fun takeoff parody on television itself. The premise is that Rob Lowe plays a television actor who, for several seasons, has played a lawyer on a sort of melodramatic TV legal series called The Grindr. And hits sort of a midlife crisis, which is a bit of a theme we're seeing in TV lately, and decides that he's going to rejoin his family's law practice and become a lawyer himself because, you know, he, quote unquote, has picked up stuff along the way. And it's a great role that's really pitched to this kind of, you know, sunnily clueless character that Lowe is great at playing. And it also has a lot of fun with the idea of, you know, how celebrity affects people and how people will buy into the idea of somebody who played a lawyer on TV being more or less, you know, qualified to play a lawyer in real life.
Well, that's a very good setup. Again, Rob Lowe is Dean. He's an actor who portrayed a lawyer on TV, as our guest just said. Here he is interjecting his thoughts on a real-life case being litigated by his actual lawyer brother, Stuart, played by Fred Savage. Let's give it a listen.
Counsel, do you mind if I counter? That seems wildly inappropriate.
We don't move. And we don't pay one more cent in rent.
Dean? I like that plan.
Are you Grindr?
Is he helping with cases?
No, he is not helping. He is not a lawyer.
Right now, this case is all about apartments and rent. But what it should be about is character. I say we turn this whole thing on its head and put Krantz on the defensive.
That sounds smart to me.
Me too, Stu.
No. This is a terrible idea. We should definitely settle. We will 100% lose the case.
I feel like I'm in a Grindr episode right now.
Season 4, episode 9, Settle to the Metal. We learned something very important in that episode. The Grindr never settles.
He never settles.
Not his nature.
Very meta. Well, let me give you a chance, Eric, to set up a scene from Adult Swim's Rick and Morty, one of the shows that you selected. Just very briefly, because we're almost up at a break here, just a quick setup if you could.
Oh, sure. Rick and Morty is it's kind of a riff on the relationship between Doc Brown and Marty McFly from the Back to the Future film franchise. Rick Sanchez is an elderly mad scientist slash alcoholic, and he takes his grandson Morty on all sorts of intergalactic and interdimensional adventures that are constantly causing them to be in potentially lethal situations.
Well, let's give it a listen.
Yeah, try not to worry about it, Morty. You're a good kid. And there's not a premium on that right now, but you'll be getting girls sometime after Brad's out of shape.
You're missing the point, Dad. I don't want girls. I want Jessica.
Ah, well, I remember feeling that way about a young lady named your mom. And that's not an urban diss. Your mom was my Jessica. I remember the first time I saw her, I thought...
I should get her pregnant, and then she'll have to marry me.
I beg your pardon, Rick. Inappropriate.
Sorry, please proceed with your story about banging my daughter in high school. I'm not sure you want to take romantic advice from this guy, Morty. His marriage is hanging from a thread.
My marriage is fine, thank you.
Jerry, it's your house. Whatever you say it is how it is, but I think a blind man could see that Beth is looking for the door. I barely have a reason to care, and even I notice.
Come on, Rick, don't talk about my parents like that.
Listen, Morty, I hate to break it to you, but what people call love is just a chemical reaction that compels animals to breed. It hits hard, Morty, then it slowly fades, leaving you stranded in a failing marriage. I did it. Your parents are gonna do it. Break the cycle, Morty. Rise above. Focus on science.
Eric, tell us why you like this show.
Well, that scene is a great example of the sort of dichotomy that the show sets up, where Rick knows all of these things about science, about different planets and other dimensions and technology, but he also has this very, like, cynical view of humanity because of that. And so the show takes this very honest look and very grounded look at the family life that the Smiths and the Sanchez's have in their home. And a lot of the episodes are sort of split between these domestic dramas and the high concept sci-fi adventures that Rick and Morty are having, and it sometimes involve the father that we heard played by Chris Parnell there, the mother played by Sarah Chalke, and Morty's sister played by Spencer Grammer. It's just a very entertaining, fast-paced, funny show that riffs both on very grounded emotional drama and the tropes of science fiction, even tropes that are just coming into fruition. This past week's episode was a riff on the Purge film franchise. And so, you know, it looks at the entire spectrum of science fiction and genre fiction and just, you know, tweaks it a little bit and provides a satirical look at it, gives a little bit of a human element to it. It's funny. It's probably very difficult to find a clip that we could play from Rick and Morty on daytime radio, just because the way that it's written, it's very it has this improvisational feel, and a lot of the dialogue from Rick is either bleeped or is only appropriate for late night on Adult Swim. We didn't get to hear from the sci-fi adventure side of the show, but that is also very funny.
We also have a tweet from Dustin. There's too much great TV, mostly non-network. Watch one, binge another, and you'll never have time to see it. Love it. We are talking about TV on the radio, talking with Eric Adams and James Poniewozik. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Eric Adams, TV editor for the AV Club, and James Poniewozik, TV critic for the New York Times. We are talking about the abundance, or perhaps the overabundance, of TV programs, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times with your thoughts about what's on TV these days. Let me get Peter from Upper Darby to join us. And Peter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I'm a psychology student at the university in the area, and I was just thinking it might be an interesting dimension to add to this discussion, that maybe this isn't a problem so much with the networks, that they're oversaturating the market, but actually that they're just responding to the way attention has changed in people. So it's much easier for people now to switch their focus very, very quickly from thing to thing and to take in lots of information all at once. And we like to do that the most through TV and movies and Netflix and those sorts of things. And I think maybe people just recognize that in the market, and so they saturated it with lots and lots of shows to give to people. So just thinking maybe the nature of attention has changed, and that's why this is happening.
Well, that's interesting. And I'm thinking, as you were talking, Peter, I was thinking of all the, you know, the binge watching that people can do as well. James, any comment back to Peter's thoughts?
I mean, I would say it's definitely not just in this respect. There's a lot of evidence that, you know, we're just becoming a much more video-oriented culture.
Right.
You know, you visit the, you know, the website of a print outlet, and a lot of, you know, things that former print publications are producing now are video. Online media consumption is often dominated by, you know, video clips of things that were on late night TV last night and so forth. So, yeah, I do think, you know, I don't know that necessarily gives people any more or less time to watch full episodes of TV series or follow them. But I do think that there is, you know, a lot more appetite for consuming video and things at various lengths. And so whether people, you know, like it or not, I think our existence is much more about, you know, switching focus between one thing and another now.
And we unfortunately, because I'm watching the clock here, I'm just going to pick out two more of the TV shows that each of you has picked. But to you, Eric, I'm just curious, do you think some shows just take too long to conclude, to get over? And I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but I'll say it anyway because I have a thing for Westerns. But I watched this show called Hell on Wheels. And I have to say, we had a good start, and now it's just every episode, nothing happens. And I'm just waiting for, you know, I guess it's a railroad to get built, but nonetheless, I just felt like, is this a trend, or am I just watching the wrong show?
You might be watching the wrong show, but, you know, that's a very modern problem for a TV show to have, to feel like, oh, gosh, this is going on forever. You know, that's
exactly
the television model is built to run forever. You want the show to go for 100 episodes so you can sell it to the local affiliates who are part of the syndication market, or you can put it on Netflix and make the money. You know, we were talking about where the money for television shows comes from earlier, and it's always been in syndication. So the idea is you want to make the most of any show that you're making. The problem is that storytelling ideas are finite, and eventually your engine runs out. Your to put it in a metaphor for Hell on Wheels, your train runs out of track.
Exactly, and I'm beginning to see through all the sort of phoniness of what they've set up there. But nonetheless, let me go back to you, James, because one of the TV shows that you picked is called The Nick. And this is Clive Owen as Dr. John Thackeray, Michael Angarano as Dr. Bertie Chickering Jr. in a scene from season one of Cinemax's turn-of-the-century medical drama. I should add that the show will return on October 16th. It's a show I watched. I thought it was pretty interesting. What do you like about it, James? And then we'll play the clip.
You know, The Nick overlaps a couple of genres that we see a fair amount on TV. You know, there are certainly tons of medical shows. There are a decent amount of period shows. The one thing that fascinates me about The Nick, besides the performances, besides how well made, you know, it's directed and produced by Steven Soderbergh, and it's a visually enthralling show. But it is that it's a period piece that really conveys a sense of immediacy. That is, it's about medicine at the turn of the 20th century, and it really manages to convey a sense that while you're watching something about the past, you're watching people who believe that they're on the cusp of an exciting future.
That's right.
That medicine and technology is changing, and you know, buildings are being electrified, and suddenly you can push a button on a wall and the room lights up. And that's a very difficult thing that really a lot of period pieces that, you know, sort of seem to be more kind of sepia toned and preserved in amber don't manage to convey. And The Nick does it really well, both through its you know, focus on how medicine is changing and how society is changing at the time in the Gilded Age. And through some very interesting just filmmaking choices that it makes, one of which is the spectacular score, which is unlike anything that you would normally expect from a period piece set in 1901. It's this fantastic sort of ambient electronic score that conveys the sense that you're watching something that's in the past and yet is futuristic at the same time.
Well, let's give it a listen.
What is that?
This is something that I invented yesterday, or the day before. It's a sheath that allows the bladder to keep its correct shape for insertion. You know, if a penis can make the trip one way and a baby the other. Look, this is what we do. We insert the basketball bladder bullet, the BBB, up into the vagina, up into the uterus, and then we leave the air tube trailing and remaining outside. We then remove the sheath so that the bladder can open. We then attach a pump to the air tube, and we pump up the bladder inside the woman so that it expands and hardens against the bleed. We then add a weight to the tube so that it puts pressure on the wound, slowing the bleeding, giving ourselves more time.
Brilliant.
And just to add to the drama, James, also Dr. John Thackeray is a drug addict on top of it.
Yeah, that definitely, and he's fantastically played by Clive Owen. You know, one not for everybody element that I should probably add is that, as you might guess from that clip, the show's also very frank and graphic in its portrayal of surgery at the
Indeed.
Time. You may need a bit of a strong stomach for it, but it's well worth it.
Well, and not to get too graphic here, but there's a scene where a woman with syphilis, and she's actually lost part of her nose, and come up with a medical treatment for that. And James, I was asking some local people here that know about medical history and Philadelphia's role in medical history, and that apparently was what they did to try to, I guess, reattach body parts.
Yep. And it's fascinating just in that sense of, you know, just learning things about medicine of the time that you didn't know. And again, I think it shows, you know, this show is also about an idea, which is that it's just this time when, you know, people were exploring this body as this fascinating machine that they didn't know much about. And through often a lot of grotesque trial and error, you know, we're discovering things that we take for granted now.
Erica, you chose iZombie. You also chose Catastrophe, and you chose a film called Review. And just for the sake of time, I'm going to pull out the clip that we have from Review. What's the setup on this?
Well, Review is about a critic who, rather than critiquing food or movies, he critiques life itself. So we're about to hear Forrest McNeil giving one of his analyses on a different life experience.
In fact, that's a perfect setup. Let's give it a listen.
On to our next review.
Ooh, our next review came to us in an email from Too Much Tanya 2000. Oh, in Madison, Wisconsin. Anyone interested in real life would want to know what racism is all about.
Racism? A dislike of others just because they're different. Well, I guess I'm going to have to change my outlook and become a racist.
So, Eric, well, what? So, what's? Why do you like this?
Oh gosh, there's so much to like about Review. First and foremost is the star, Andy Daly. He's this guy who's been sort of a character actor, a face you might recognize from other projects for years. And this is just like the perfect vehicle for his talent. He has this knack for playing these characters who have a very sunny disposition and a very sort of vivacious presence, but have this deep, dark, terrible secret beneath them. And Forrest's problem is that he thinks that he's living life by doing these reviews of experiences that people are too scared to have themselves or have moral objections to, as heard in the prompt for the racism review. But really, he's denying his own life. He winds up cutting off everyone, every personal connection he has in this process, because he's so convinced that his work is of merit and is illuminating the human experience, while it's actually just destroying his own. So it's a beautiful tragic comedy that is just immaculately structured. I likened it on Twitter last week to watching an episode is sort of like the climb on a roller coaster.
Oh, sure.
Because sure. you always know what's coming, but you're surprised at how terrible and how terrifying the things over the hill actually are.
And I should add that Review is currently in the middle of its second season. Let me get Kelly from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kelly. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. My question was, does all of this quality scripted television finally possibly mean an end to reality television?
Is this spell the end for reality television, James Poniewozik?
No. There's plenty of hours of TV to fill up out there. And also, I have to say, like, as a TV critic, I don't really believe in beating up on reality television across the board. There's outstanding reality television and there's bad reality TV, just like there are outstanding books and bad books, and, you know, outstanding scripted shows and bad scripted shows. I'd still watch Survivor with my family every week, and I do not apologize for it. You know, I do think that I think that the creative energy has left reality TV a little bit, just because, you know, it had such a hot period over the past decade where so many new concepts were coming out, and there haven't been as many exciting new shows. But no, I think reality TV will continue in various forms, and further, I will say I do not have a problem with that.
Well, and nor do I. Let me get Cody from Downingtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Cody. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. This is awesome. So I personally don't watch a lot of TV on TV. There's a ton of shows that I really like The Walking Dead, Rick and Morty, which got mentioned, iZombie, all these shows. I love, but I don't have much time to catch them when they're actually on TV. So somehow I'll have to watch online. Other ones I wait until the full season comes out on Netflix. So, if, you know, I don't have to wait a week to see the resolve. If I have a night, I can watch 3 episodes, and then maybe I'll go a week. I haven't been able to watch any episodes. I wonder how that, on top of there being so many options, also the option to not watch these programs while they're on television, how that's affected viewership and possibly, like, the continuation of a series, because people aren't watching it when it's on TV. They're sure. Waiting until it comes out on Netflix.
Cody, I appreciate the call, and I know you're not alone. I mean, I think in many ways this is how people watch television. Eric, do you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that habit is really what's allowed the streaming platforms to explode and to expand into their own original programming that people are accustomed to not waiting around a whole week for a new episode. They've grown used to having the next episode loaded for them as soon as the first one is ending on Netflix. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily help the shows that aren't getting live viewership. Viewership will be boosted by DVR viewership, but that's still a number that advertisers are a little skeptical of. And, you know, as much as TV has expanded into these non-advertising realms, advertising money is still a very big part about how TV gets made. And so, you know, that's why you see a show like NBC's Hannibal, which was a beautiful, very vivid
you chose
program.
That word very carefully. Yes, vivid.
Yes. For 3 years.
I couldn't stand even hearing that show, but go ahead, Eric. We're almost out of time.
It had a very small viewership. It hung on for a while on the metrics that have come into play, the live plus 3 dates, the live plus 30, all these DVR metrics. But that could only save it for so long, even though it was partially funded by an international production company. You know, there are many new ways for money to come into television, which is great. Unfortunately, delayed viewing isn't always going to save a show, and watching stuff on streaming is never going to tell us how popular a program is, because Netflix and Amazon and Hulu still kind of withhold those numbers, as the person who kicked off our conversation, John Landgraf, famously accused Netflix of a few years ago.
Well, we came full circle, and always fun to talk about television on the radio. Eric Adams, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Marty. It was a blast.
It was a blast for us as well. TV editor for the AV Club, co-host of their podcast, I Know It Sounds Crazy, James Poniewozik, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. TV critic for the New York Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.